this episode of the Center for Hebraic Thought podcast is going to be a bit different. One of the main problems I run into when I tell people that I work on the thinking of the biblical authors, the Hebraic thought in the Bible, is they just say, well, that's not really a philosophy. That's not really speculative thought. That's not really an intellectual world. And I say, why not? And they say, well, they didn't do that. You know, that's what the Greeks did, Plato and Aristotle, and later the European tradition. But for some reason, most people, for reasons that we're going to discuss in this interview, just don't view the biblical authors as philosophically savvy people. At best, they might think that Paul was philosophically savvy because he engaged the philosophers. But here we're going to talk to Dr. Brian Van Norden, who is an esteemed professor of Chinese philosophy. He teaches both in China and in Vassar College in the United States. And he's going to talk about his experiences trying to get Western philosophers to think of Chinese and Indian philosophy as legitimate philosophy. And it turns out he's had the exact same problem. People have maybe sometimes a very subtle racist bent that they're not racist, but it's come down to them that only white people can do philosophy, which actually that was a view of some philosophers in the past. Or they just don't know any of the literature, or they don't think of it as philosophical, so therefore it can't be philosophical. So stay tuned with us for this roving discussion of Dr. Brian Van Norden and all of his experiences in the public sphere, trying to convince people that there are other styles of philosophical thinking than just what the Greeks and the Europeans did. And it's worth listening to those other styles as well.
Yeah, there's two issues here. One issue is simple ignorance. So of the approximately 118 doctoral programs in philosophy in the U.S., only 10 have anybody on the regular faculty who teaches Chinese philosophy. Only 6 have anyone who teaches Indian philosophy. And there's even fewer people who teach the indigenous philosophies of the people of the Americas, and then a handful of people who teach Africana philosophy. And so part of the reason that we don't teach it more is simply that people don't know about it. But I think there's also a more insidious reason, which is that when you ask people, why don't you consider hiring someone who teaches, say, Indian or Chinese philosophy, they respond by saying, well, there is no philosophy in those traditions. Now, why would people assume that? Especially if you introduce yourself as a specialist like me in Chinese Right. philosophy or Indian philosophy. And unfortunately, the only explanation I've been able to find is there's a kind of systematic racism that goes back centuries. Kant and the Kantians wrote non-Western philosophy out of the philosophy curriculum. People used to be interested in Indian philosophy. They used to be interested in Chinese philosophy, including philosophy professors. The Jesuits, who were highly trained in Western philosophy, gave the first translation into a European language of the Analects, the sayings of Confucius, and they translated them as Confucius Sinarum Philosophus, Confucius the Chinese philosopher. And people were similarly very interested in Indian philosophy. But then Kant came along, and Kant said in his lectures that only white people are capable of doing philosophy. And he said, for example, that the very idea of philosophy never entered the heads of the Chinese. And he said that East Indians look like philosophers, his words, but they're really incapable of the abstraction necessary for philosophical thought. Now, I'm not suggesting that my contemporary colleagues in philosophy would overtly accept any of these terribly racist claims. But the fact is that people, if told that there is great philosophy in India and China, will dismiss that out of hand and just say, no, there isn't. I know there isn't. You know, I don't need to read anything to know there isn't. And that's the heritage of this Kantian bias that there couldn't be any philosophy outside the Anglo-European tradition.
Yeah, that's good. And in fact, I first ran into your work through an op-ed that you wrote for the New York Times with the name or the title, If Philosophy Won't Diversify, Let's Call It What It Really Is. And I both, I was pointing and yelling the whole time I was reading it going, yes, this is it. This is what I've been waiting for. I'm glad somebody else feels this way.
Yeah.
Like comrade in arms. And when you say, let's call it what it really is, you mean, I think you said, let's call it an Anglo-American or European Department of Philosophy. Is that correct?
Yeah, it turns out my colleague Jay Garfield, who was an analytically trained philosopher, but became interested in Tibetan and Indian philosophy and learned Tibetan and Sanskrit in order to translate it and teach it. I ran into him at a conference. And he said, you know, these departments that won't teach any philosophy outside the Anglo-European canon should just call themselves departments of Anglo-European philosophy. And I said, that's a great point. Why don't we write an editorial about that? And we got lucky, and it came out in the New York Times. And the reaction was fascinating because on the one hand, a lot of people said, like you did, absolutely right. It's about time. Somebody pointed out how narrow the canon of received text is in most American, Canadian, and even European philosophy departments. But a lot of other people responded by saying things like, one of my favorite critical comments was somebody said, oh, come on, do you really want to fly in a plane that was built with non-Western mathematics? Mm-hmm. And I felt like saying, you know, there's a thing called Arabic numerals that were actually, you know, the number zero, which yep. was, you know, the notation for zero, which was discovered in India, they're kind of catching on. Yep. And so personally, I will only fly in a plane built with non-European mathematics.
Yeah, that's the levels of ignorance are amazing. Actually, zero, I think the history of mathematicians are going to say the Sumerians had a null placeholder, but it died with them in their sesimogesimal numbering system.
Well, that's fascinating. See, I learned something today too.
Yeah. So there is this, you know, we can call it a soft racism, but there is, you know, the anthropologists Franz Boas and Margaret Mead, and they kind of reintroduced anthropologists to the idea that it's not the civilized world that goes out and kind of explores and examines the uncivilized world, but that the quote unquote uncivilized world has something to teach us about ourselves and then stepping out of that progressivist narrative. So I wonder how much just flat views of progressivism are contributing to this as much. We've come so much farther than they, and you know, there's a serious question as to whether we ever have or whether they were that far behind or whether there isn't ahead and behind. So I my question is going to be, and you can spin this in a different direction if you like, but what for you is philosophy? And I fully understand. In preparation for a book, I started looking up what people define philosophy as, and I realized there are as many definitions of philosophy as there are philosophers.
Yes.
But what's the basic operating definition that you're working off of, and why does both Plato and Aristotle and also Confucius or Lao Tzu, or I'm mispronouncing these and I'm sorry in advance.
That's okay.
Why do these all fit that definition?
Great question. I talk about this at length in my book, which was inspired by the New York Times op-ed. As you know, I wrote a book, Taking Back Philosophy, A Multicultural Manifesto.
Excellent book.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And in the book, I point out that there isn't a definition of philosophy that's going to apply to all and only people who identify as philosophers, even if we limit our gaze to the Anglo-European tradition. Because there are things that were philosophy at certain periods in history that are now physics. Newton considered himself a natural philosopher. Galileo considered himself a philosopher. If you told them they weren't a philosopher, they would have been deeply offended by the suggestion that they weren't philosophers. And interestingly, Newton argued with Leibniz, who's now still part of the philosophical canon, about whether space was absolute or relative. Leibniz said that space was relative, and he turned out to be right, actually. But as I point out in the book, if you say, ha ha, see, the philosophers were right about that, Newton would say, excuse me, I'm a philosopher too.
Right, right.
So, but if we ask, what is philosophy for us now? I think we can give a definition. Philosophy, I'd say, is the discipline where we discuss issues that we regard as important, but we don't agree about the methodology for how to solve them. So once you figure out what the methodology is for dealing with a problem and we agree about that methodology more or less, it becomes a separate field. So physics spins off from philosophy once we agree what the method of physics is. Mathematics spins off from philosophy once we agree about what the distinctive methodology of mathematics is. But there are always going to be these questions that we know are important, but we're not going to agree about the methodology for resolving them. Questions like, what is the purpose of human life, or does human life have a purpose? If you think that human life doesn't have a purpose, you're still taking a stance on a philosophical issue. Or does science tell us everything there is to know about the universe? And ironically, that's not a question that science can answer. Science can't tell you whether science tells you everything about the world. So that question about the limits of science will always be a philosophical question. And then if we look at, and I give a bunch of examples of this in chapter 2 of Taking Back Philosophy, if we look at the kinds of questions that we now consider distinctively philosophical, we find that those questions are also addressed in other traditions. So, for example, Descartes gives an argument that there has to be a self, which is a substance distinct from the self substance of other people. And he says, you know, how do you know this is true? And part of Descartes' argument is he says, well, no one denies that there is a thing that persists through qualitative changes. Actually, Buddhist philosophers deny precisely that, and they give arguments that there isn't a self that persists through qualitative changes. Or another example I like to give is in the Western tradition, Plato's list of the cardinal virtues, the most important virtues or the virtues that subsume all the other virtues, is one of the most widely accepted. Plato in the Republic, as you know, says that wisdom, justice, courage, and temperance or moderation, however you want to translate sophrosune, are the four virtues that encompass all other important virtues. I've always found that a really puzzling list of the most important virtues. And in the Confucian tradition, they have a list that goes back to the Confucian philosopher Mengzi of benevolence, righteousness, wisdom, and propriety. That's always seemed to me like a much more plausible list of what the most important human virtues are. So here are just two examples on topics where we can see thinkers in the Asian tradition are clearly dealing with philosophical topics. They're giving arguments in favor of their position. They're responding to objections to those positions. But they've been excluded from the philosophical discussion for some reason, most charitably ignorance. But I think often you also have to attribute it to a kind of systemic racism.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I've run into this when I, because I was in a little while in the analytic tradition and then got out for my own sanity, took what was good in that tradition and went back into biblical theology. But when I would put this out there that there are other four, you know, do you think that Indians and Chinese and Africans never had a philosophical thought, or, you know, and they say, yeah, but they never wrote it down. And I think that's what becomes part of the problem is there's this general sentiment that there's a particular literary style of discourse that is philosophical and nothing else is. So so a poem is not philosophical. It might be lovely and expressive, which I think that view of poetry actually comes from German Romanticism.
Right.
But there's no way in which poetry could be powerful, forceful, persuasive, logically rigorous in any way in their mind. So I wonder in your specialty in Chinese philosophy, and feel free to drag in Indian or Hindu or Buddhist ideas in here as well. What are the primary literary techniques to make philosophical arguments?
Well, yeah, I have encountered this line of argument. I've encountered it as well. And the thing that always amazes me is that it's like people don't recognize how diverse the genres in which Western philosophy is written are. Yeah. I mean, Plato writes in the dialogue format. There's dialogues in Mengzi, in Zhuangzi, in Indian philosophy. The Bhagavad Gita, one of the classics of Indian philosophy, is an extended philosophical dialogue. People say, oh, it's poetry as opposed to philosophy. Have you ever heard of Parmenides, the seminal figure in the Western tradition who wrote a long poem about the nature of being? Or people say, well, you know, Chinese philosophy is just aphoristic. Yeah, guess what? So's Pascal. So's Wittgenstein's Tractatus, which is one of the most, I mean, it's a bunch of basically aphorisms.
Not to mention Nietzsche.
Nietzsche, exactly. Another excellent example. So, and you do find in the Chinese tradition, you do find philosophical dialogues. You find philosophical essays. The Mohists, who are the, among the first philosophers in the Chinese tradition, write excellent essays in favor of impartial caring, as opposed to a kind of differentiated care. It's the classic debate in Western philosophy between whether or not there are what Nagel referred to as agent-relative prohibitions. Are there some obligations I have as the individual I am, like an obligation to care for my parents just because they're my parents? Or is my obligation to care for my parents just a special instance of my general obligation to care for all human beings? The Confucians say, yeah, you do have these agent-relative obligations. The Mohists, their critics, write these clear philosophical essays using thought experiments and clear arguments saying, no, you only have an obligation to care for human beings in general, not merely because someone happens to be your mother or father. So you find all the different genres of philosophical writings in every tradition. And again, it's just, it's one of those biases that people think, oh, all of Chinese philosophy is aphoristic and nothing that's aphoristic could be philosophical. A, there's plenty of Chinese philosophy that is not aphoristic. And B, there's plenty of Western philosophy that is aphoristic.
Yeah, and this recent book I've been working on for a biblical view of philosophy, I just started listing out everything that I taught in intro to philosophy classes, just listed out the styles of literature. And I was actually shocked at how much diversity is required to approach the typical Western philosophical canon today, just as far as a literary diversity, which was, again, the first thing that was foisted in my face as to why these Hebrew texts don't count. And so I think there is just a lack of accounting. I also wonder, you know, myself and one of your former colleagues, Malcolm Keating, we actually took an Asian philosophy class together in an analytic department.
It
blew open the doors and it caused him to actually go into full-time study of Indian philosophy. It was fantastic. And I wonder if part of the end game here can be had by getting those courses early on in undergrad and graduate level philosophy instruction exposure, because really the issue is not whether there's philosophy. For me, the question is, how do they do philosophy within their tradition? How do they write it up literarily? What techniques do they use?
And then once you
basically acquiesce to say they have philosophically rigorous thinking, I just need to figure out how they're doing what they're doing. Then it just becomes, you know, the chore of examination.
Exactly. And you mentioned our mutual friend Malcolm Keating, who teaches at Yale and U.S. College in Singapore. I was visiting there for 3 years. I just returned to Vassar College. You know, where I have my permanent position. But Yale and U.S. has this wonderful two-semester philosophy sequence required of all first-year students, Philosophy and Political Thought 1 and 2. And it's a multicultural introduction to philosophy and political thought. They read Plato and Aristotle side by side with Confucians like Mengzi and Taoists like Zhuangzi and the Questions of King Milinda, which is a great Buddhist work.
Yeah,
and the Bhagavad Gita, which is a classic work, which is all kinds of Indian traditions use, although I think of it and I see it myself mostly through the lens of Vedanta philosophy. And they find that there's no problem teaching these things side by side and bringing them into constructive dialogue. Or another of my favorite examples is I really enjoy teaching Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan on political theory, but there's a great critique of the kind of authoritarianism that Hobbes endorses in the Chinese Confucian philosopher Huang Zongxi, who never knew about Hobbes, but is responding to just the kind of extremely authoritarian approach to political philosophy that Hobbes seems to endorse and argues for why you need what are essentially checks and balances in government, completely independently of people like Montesquieu.
Now, your book, Taking Back Philosophy, A Multicultural Manifesto, that's an expansion of that New York Times op-ed piece, right? It's taking the thesis.
Yes. And so in the first chapter discusses the editorial and the response to it and responds to some of the common objections that are given against multicultural philosophy. Chapter two, I give some concrete examples of how you can bring into dialogue people like Descartes and Buddhist philosophers on the nature of the self, Hobbes and Confucian philosophers on the nature of political authority, why, despite myself being a big fan of Aristotle's philosophy, I think the Confucian Mengzi actually has a much more plausible account of how ethical cultivation occurs. Because as I think you know, Aristotle says that you become good through habituation. Right. You become, you know, just by performing just actions, and you become courageous by performing courageous actions. But he also thinks that by nature, humans are neither good nor bad. And so you start out from a morally inert human nature, and then you have to acquire the virtues. And it's always been obscure how that was supposed to happen. Right. And the Confucian philosopher Mengzi says the only way it could be possible for you to become virtuous is if you have the sprouts of virtue. Innate but incipient dispositions towards virtuous feeling, thinking, and perception that can be developed into full-blown virtues. Otherwise, ethical cultivation would be impossible. So by reading Mengzi in connection with Aristotle, you get to see more clearly a potential weakness in Aristotle's thought and also see how a Confucian might provide a solution to that.
Yeah, I think that the task for Hebraic philosophy is to actually, it's the opposite of your problem, which is it's too familiar to many people in the West because of the Christian canon. And it has to be foreignized again in some way in order for them to see it afresh to say, because I'm thinking about what would be the kind of Torah argument about exactly what you're saying here. And there is a full-blown argument throughout the Torah through poetry, narrative, and legal texts interplaying with each other. But again, you have to take that initial step to say there's something to be said about the nature of humanity and what they're disposed toward and how ethics can be fostered. And of course, the Torah takes a very communal approach to ethics, as well as I think a lot of Chinese and Buddhist philosophy does, where the Greeks tended to be slightly more individualistic.
And that's a great point, if I may. I mean, just because I have a colleague, she's now a dean, Professor Sarah Thomas, Sarah Rebecca Thomas, and she told me an anecdote about teaching in a general humanities course at Bard College many years ago. And she was saying that the tricky thing was when you're teaching, for example, the Bible, as that's conceptualized in canonized in the Christian tradition, part of the difficulty is, on the one hand, you have some students in the class and they say, oh, okay, we're going to read the Bible. We're going to talk about how stupid it is and what a bad influence it's had and how we should just laugh at it. And then you got another segment of students who are like, oh, the Bible, we're going to talk about how this is all holy writ. And I already know how to interpret it because I've been reading this since I was seven. Mm-hmm. And I already know exactly how to interpret all of this. And the dual challenge in teaching a canonical text like this is you've got to win over the skeptics and say, this is a work worth taking seriously. People haven't been reading this for thousands of years because it's a stupid work that we can just laugh off. Right. But on the other hand, you have to talk to the true believers and say, I'm not trying to talk you out of your beliefs, but I want you to understand that there are other people who are just as sincere in their faith as you are, who have read this work in radically different ways. And I want you to become aware of that and to understand their perspective, whether you end up agreeing with it or not. And that double bind is often tricky. And you have the same thing. This became clear to me when you're teaching, for example, the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita in Singapore, which has a significant Indian population. And so, you know, people have a presupposition about how this works, and the Gita has a role in Indian nationalism now. So, you know, this or Confucians, I've had, you know, students disagree with translations from the classical Chinese because they've learned a little classical Chinese in high school for the purposes of writing contemporary prose. But what they've learned is, what do classical Chinese expressions mean now, not what did they mean in their original context? It's kind of like an example I love to use is, we all know the expression, blood is thicker than water. And some people know that that expression comes from Shakespeare, but most people don't know that the expression in Shakespeare means the exact opposite of what we take it to mean. And so in Shakespeare, blood is thicker than water means your relatives with whom you only share water by biology, that's not a significant bond. What's a significant bond is the blood you've spilt in battle or the blood oaths you've taken with your friends. That's what's really important. And so history plays these jokes on us where things often mean the opposite originally of what we thought they meant. And so the trick when you're teaching the Bible or you're teaching Confucianism or you're teaching the Gita is getting the true believers, the people who were raised on these texts, to open up to the possibility that it's at least possible this text meant something different originally from what you were led to believe. And you're entitled to your belief, but I want you to be open to the fact that there are these other traditions that I can tell you about.
Yes, I'm very familiar with those dynamics.
I'm sure.
Yeah, and essentially, you know, my task is always, I want to show you that it's doing a lot more than you think, and then we can talk about the various things more that it's doing, but it's doing more than you could possibly imagine. I wonder, that multicultural manifesto part, if you know, could snap your fingers and make three things happen today, what would it be that you think needs to change in order for the West to kind of, because my feeling from a little bit of time in the analytic philosophy world is that there actually is a growing and intensifying interest in Western philosophy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But does not seem to be reciprocated by us. They want to understand what the European philosophers have said and from Greeks on, but we not so much. So I wonder what you would do if you could just change things tomorrow that you think would kind of instigate the kinds of changes that need to happen.
Well, I think one thing that would help is if people would just read some non-Western philosophy. So instead of pontificating about things you haven't read, actually take a look at, for example, the Mohist writings on impartial caring. Take a look at things like the questions of King Melinda and the famous chariot argument for the non-existence of the stuff.
By the way, that's the one that that like completely flipped me over into, wow, they are really thinking about the metaphysics of the universe in a way that I have never thought about it before.
Yeah. And it's just... I mean, again, for our readers, it's in the Questions of King Melinda. That's a long work, you know, but you can get some excerpts of it in various anthologies. And as you know, the basic line of argument is a king and a Buddhist a monk are arguing, and the Buddhist monk says, "Well, I'm called Nagasena, but that's just a name. There's really no person as such to be found." And the king says, "Well, that's ridiculous. How could that be true?" And the monk Nagasena says, "Well, I'm sure as a wealthy, powerful person, you didn't walk here today. You came on a chariot, right?" He says, "Yes." "What is the chariot?" And they go through this nice dialectical process and say, "Is the chariot any part of the chariot? Is the chariot its wheel?" "No, because the wheel could break and you'd still call it a chariot. Or you could replace the wheel and it would still call it the chariot." "Is the chariot something different from all of its parts?" "Well, no. How could the chariot be a thing different from its parts?" Well, then, is the chariot the sum total of all the parts?
And this is where all the Westerners are like, yes, finally, that's the answer.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, same experience. The students all start nodding like, yeah, there you go, that's the answer. And then you say, well, but if that's what it was, if the chariot were the sum total of all the parts, then if one single part changed, the chariot would be gone. And is that really what you think a chariot is? And you realize, no, chariot's just a name we use to refer to the parts, but it's not a thing. It's just a convention we have about when you call it the same chariot. An example I sometimes use with my students is I says, you guys probably are too young to remember the group The Who, but when the drummer for The Who, Keith Moon, died tragically of a drug overdose, is it the same group or not? There's not a fact. There's not a metaphysical entity, The Who. It's just a linguistic convention we have about calling the group The Who, and whether we call it The Who or not is purely a matter of linguistic convention. So it's likewise just a linguistic convention whether we identify this chariot as the same chariot as the parts change. But then it's just a linguistic convention whether we identify Brian Van Norden as that baby who was born a long time ago in Western Pennsylvania, 57 years ago in Western Pennsylvania. Is that baby the same thing as the adult who's teaching this class now? That's merely a linguistic convention. There's not a thing in the universe that corresponds to Van Norden. Or if there is, we can't identify it because I'm not identical with any of my parts. I'm not identical with all of my parts, or else any change would mean I was gone. And how could I be identical with something distinct from all my parts? And it's just a really powerful philosophical argument. You know, whether you like it or not, right, you're confronted with a philosophical argument from another tradition that really makes you think.
Which I think the way that you've summarized and paraphrased that story, I think everybody listening, even if they've never read that before, they'll say, oh, yeah, that's clearly doing some kind of philosophical anthropology. The kind that we could put directly in conversation with other discussions in the West on anthropology. I will say though, the way it's written out, and I think you also have to be able to have a professor over your shoulder saying, "Hey, this is worth it. Let's read it together."
It helps
as well. Yeah, this is valuable, and so we're going to talk about this together because I think a lot of people. Well, I had the experience. I was in an analytic program, and you would see different reactions to that story. You know, when we read it and prepared to discuss it, you know, some people, their reaction was, "I couldn't make heads or tails of what this guy was doing." Right, and
yeah,
I'm thinking it's the same. You know, the same person that if you're reading a Platonic dialogue would have gone all the way down the road with it and sliced it and diced it. Right?
Exactly. That's just it. I mean, if Plato was not already in the philosophical canon, I really wonder if we could get Plato into the Western philosophical canon. Because of the style in which he writes. And like, what are some of the most famous things in Plato's writings? The parable of the cave.
Right,
It's a parable. It's a metaphor. Or the divided line, which is also a metaphor. These are some of the most widely studied and analyzed. People have written dissertations just on these metaphors. But if Plato was not part of the canon and we tried to introduce him, they'd say, well, look, this isn't real philosophy. It's some kind of poetry and there's all this metaphor stuff. I don't get it. We forget how hard it is to understand a lot of Western philosophy. Mm-hmm. And then we're unwilling to invest the same amount of energy in understanding non-Western philosophy. And I think that's just bias. That's just intellectual laziness. There's no excuse for that.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Brian Van Norden, thank you so much for being on the podcast with us.
Oh, no, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Center for Hebraic Thought podcast. Be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave us a review wherever you found us. Want to learn more about Hebraic Thought? Visit our website at HebraicThought.org.